Session number 6184, reel 3.
Mr. Woodhouse, tape 3.
Just depended really upon what sort of terrain we were working in. All the time one was on level ground, it was the working hours were short, and the camp would be moved really quite frequently. But when one came to the more difficult country, where there were cuttings, there were embankments, and odd bridges and that sort of thing, which we often had to weigh in with, if the railway had held up, might stay in a camp a good deal longer.
So you would catch up the...
Sometimes, yes. Well, almost catch them up. The Japanese were in such a hurry to get this railway finished that at one stage they actually laid the lines and built the embankment under it. They propped the lines up on heavy blocks of timber, having joined them all up, and then filled the earth in underneath. Or we filled the earth in underneath.
Was that the period at which you were working alongside the engineer Takahashi?
He came in a little later. He was one of the engineer. And he was one of the better disposed Japs. He was the only one, in fact, I came across, who had a sense of humour. And one could talk to. He was a well-disposed man by any standards. He was an engine driver. And he's quite the laziest man I think I've ever met. And at that time, I'd been sent up with a party of men to the railway siding, living by this Japanese camp, to maintain engines. At that time, the engines were coming up the line with rations and so on. And the Japanese assume everybody can do everything. And having arrived at this encampment, I was told I was going to be engine soldier, which meant I had to be fireman. Well, I'd never been on a footplate in my life. I'd seen pictures of them in books. But one of the chaps in the section I'd taken knew something about it. And he said, it's easy enough. You know, it was a wood burn. You chuck the wood in there and that sort of thing. And show me how to damp the thing down at night to keep just a head of steam up for the next morning. And it wasn't too bad. So Tagas was a generous man, really. He didn't smoke. He gave me such cigarettes as he got and certain rations and wouldn't let me to do any other work except this engine. He said, no, you engine soldier, you no work all. Which I was very happy to do, but he'd come out from his hut of a morning to start work on this engine, which was at that time hauling up gravel from a river cutting to lay between the sleepers. And he'd look round immediately. He was looking for a box and some cotton waste to sit on. And then he'd sit down and say to me, Zindagog, which meant cylinder cock. I had to start the engine off. And then he'd say, whistle 2 times. And I had to even reach over his head and blow the train whistle. But we got on remarkably well. In fact, he was so good to me, when I got a recurrence of malaria, he brought an extra blanket round and some quinine tablets, which we couldn't get at that time. But I made a resolution that after the war I'd send him a present because it was valuable by any man's standards. And I got him to write his name and address in Japanese, because he couldn't write English and I couldn't write Japanese, on a piece of paper, which I kept. And I would honestly have sent him a very nice present after the war. But unfortunately, when we got to Japan much later, during a search, I was found to have this Japanese writing. I mean, I got a beating up for having it, and it was taken off me, so I never know what happened to Gas or Heat or me, presumably.
Were the camps you lived in all much the same sort of standard?
They were very much the same character. They weren't all these attack huts. They were nearly all, quite close to native kampongs, or villages. And they followed the rail line, obviously. There was no prison camp atmosphere about them, whatever. I mean, you didn't need it. Where did you go if you got out?
You used to get out occasionally at night,
didn't
you?
A lot of people did. You might have something to trade yourself, or you might want to buy some food. I still had a little money left. If you could get into the local nearest village, the Thai village, they would all chaffer with you for food and eggs and an occasional duck or chicken or something like that, which is very valuable. But in addition to that, there were chaps who wanted to trade and didn't want to run the risk of going out, so you'd really let it be known you were going out to the camp, say, 2 or 3 nights' time. Anybody wanted anything traded. You took a risk in doing it, a very considerable risk, and you had to be fair to people. They had to be fair to you as well. Once you were out, you had to sell the stuff. You had to do the best you could with the natives, and you took a percentage, obviously, of what you sold it for, was your risk.
What sort of reception did you get in the villages when you arrived?
Very good in the main. If it was something to trade, they were always very interested. You see, the Siamese, I think, were strictly neutral. They didn't like us in much more. They liked the Japanese, really. We were both strangers in their country, independent-minded people. And like all Asiatics, they were good human. They seemed to accept us. I think they favoured us rather more than the Japanese, because the Japanese really were the masters in there. They soon came to dislike the Japanese intensely, the way their inflation soared with the Japanese money, the new Japanese yen and so on.
Did you have much difficulty in bargaining with them?
No. They were hard bargainers, and you'd sit there and chaffer away. And in the end, you'd all grin at each other, and the money would jump the goods.
And what sort of cap did you take?
I used to take 25%.
Did you ever get caught?
No. I came very near it times, but just lucky.
So you just creep out and...
Didn't really need to creep. The only need to creep was to avoid any Japanese sea. So there weren't sentries in the sense that we understand it now, and there was no barrier. The thing was, if you had a Japanese who did happen to be wandering around and saw you out of camp at about your quarters at night, and certainly coming back or taking stuff out, that's when you were in trouble.
What was your food like?
It got worse. Because we couldn't complain so much, really, as the chaps who'd gone up country laying the embankment, because they were well ahead of us. And where we went, of course, the railway went. And the food came up mainly on the railway, or partly by river, except during monsoon when the rivers were in spate and it got a bit difficult, because the rivers came down from the north. The difficulty for the people further up was that when the rations were put on the train, they were cannibalised at almost every stop by the Japanese on the way up. You take things off. So by the time it reached the rail head, there was very little left of what had started.
And so what sort of things were you getting?
We were getting much the same thing, only in smaller quantities. Rice and so-called vegetables.
To what extent was it possible to supplement that with things you got by barter?
Well, you could barter, and of course, if you've got time, anybody who wasn't working could just get out of the camp. But you could trap animals like iguanas if you get them. A lot of chaps found those very tasty. They're a biggish animal, and the hinder parts, if they were broiled over a fire, tasted rather like, not unlike chicken. They're rather nice. Some experiment with snakes and snails and all sorts of things. I found it snails a bit.
So did you manage to, or did many people manage to trap?
Some who had a certain amount of expertise. It required a little ingenuity, and to this day I don't know precisely what sort of traps they worked. I know they caught them.
Would that food be shared out? Or?
Oh no! That was the perks of the chaps who'd caught it, because they took a risk in being just outside the Canby area, and theirs was the ingenuity that made the trap. And
what were your clothes like by that stage?
Very tattered. See, khaki drill that we had didn't last long. You sweat a lot and it tends to rot it and that sort of thing. Boots soon went, and socks and that sort of thing. A lot of us by this time were bootless and shoeless. And we used to make what we called a Jap happy, a Japanese pair of pants, which was all one needs for that is a length of material about, say, a foot wide or even slightly less. Maybe 3 feet long. Lay it on the ground, and across one of its narrower ends, you sew a piece of cotton or a piece of tape, if you can get a piece of string. Then, holding the thing behind, you tie the string around your waist, pull the other end of the foot-wide piece under your legs, and tuck it over the piece in front. You've got a pair of Japanese pants. A Jap happy used to be called. Most of us had those, but to get material for those finally got a bit difficult.
Were you able to shave or anything like that?
No. I'd been without a razor, so I took a number of safety razors, safety razor blades into the prison camp with me, but they soon wore out. And such is the British Army system, it still amuses me to this day. In spite of the fact that I couldn't shave, I had to get permission to grow a beard. Presumably, had the admission been refused, I'd have had to forbid my whiskers to grow. I don't know.
What were you being paid for work on the road?
Again, 10 cents a day, which wasn't fast. And if one didn't work, one didn't get paid. And went on half rations, incidentally. The Japs always paid to put you on half rations if you didn't work. It's curious logic.
What were the dangers of the brakeman's job?
The brakeman was quite hazardous. It was all right initially. But when one got further up country with very, very narrow cuttings between sort of rock walls, with the danger of any of these sleepers fouling them and knocking the whole thing off, it became a good deal worse. And following the death of two Japanese who were flung off these things, I think one had a rail actually driven through him, the Japanese decided it was much too dangerous for the Japs, so they put us on it. And I was sent up to one of these siding camps with a party of men to man these things going up. The difficulty was about this, that since the thing was being pushed, and there were about a dozen trucks on this, you were a long, long way in front of the engine, which didn't have very strong braking power anyway. And if you saw anything like danger threatening, you would signal with a flag, and then you start screwing this brake thing down like mad, in the hope that the people on the Japs on the lorry at the back would act equally quickly, bring the whole thing to a halt. But we weren't very happy about it. It's very dangerous. And I think I would have been killed, in fact. But one day it was my turn to go up with the next lot. And a chap I was quite friendly with at the time, Chalky White, he was a gunner, said, "Do you mind if I go up on this one, Tom?" He said, "You take my turn later on." I said, "No, it's all right." But just out of the actual campsite, he was thrown off the thing got derailed. He was thrown off down an embankment which was still littered with sawn-off bamboo stumps. And the whole of the rails and sleepers went on top of him, as far as I could judge. He lived 3 days, but he was a dying man from the time he was hit, and they couldn't do anything with poor Chalk. He was buried out in little... We buried him out in a little... after due rites and ceremonies, of course, in a little little clearing.
Were there many work accidents?
Well, quite a lot. I mean, you couldn't help it in any circumstances, I suppose, even in this country where you get men doing physical work. The possibility of accidents is a good deal higher than those doing desk jobs, that's quite obvious. Here, particularly so, because the tools were cruder, not so good. The Japs were driving for speed, and things were necessarily a good deal more careless. But the chief enemy was, you see, our own MOs, our own medical were excellent. They really were. They had the worst job of the lot, in my view. They knew exactly what ailed a man and exactly what he needed to cure him, but they couldn't do it. But I'm quite certain a lot of those, the character of those, a lot of those men was such they kept men alive by sheer faith. They knew exactly what we wanted. We had, if you scratch yourself, you see, you could have cut on the some of this bamboo. You had a septic sore, which turned into a tropic ulcer in no time. And stinking things. I've seen entire shin bones laid bare. Legs had to be taken off finally at the knee, very off.
You had sores yourself, didn't you?
I had, yes, I did on the feet, but didn't get those until later. At that time I was in fairly good health. The food I'd had and was managing it up to that time, it kept me in pretty good nick. It wasn't until a bit later on I caught cholera and got over that, and then got malaria and dysentery and various other things, and my health started to go a bit.
So how long was it that you were working before you came down with cholera?
I think I got halfway up the railway to, I think I was at that time, Tom John Spring Camp, it was known as, where, curiously, I was the NCO in charge of anti-cholera precautions, and I was rigidly carrying them out myself. It meant seeing every man before he went to draw his food, immersed his eating irons and mist it and so on in boiling water and washed his hands, and I was the first one down with it.
So there hadn't been any cholera before?
No, I don't know much about it, I'm not a doctor, I think it's a waterborne thing, really. But it goes through in the tropics like a dose of salts. And the trouble was that the camps further up were manned to a large extent by labourers from, I think, Indochina and Tamils, who from Malaya, who'd been brought up with promises by the Japanese of a lot of money and that sort of thing. And they'd no idea, really, of even elementary hygiene, all the other things. Dysentery amongst them was terrible. They no idea of controlling flies or keeping food clean. But the cholera, when they got it, they would get out of the camps and start walking back to the, presumably to get back to Malaya, I don't know. But a lot of them would die where they fell, and the disease would simply spread.
You'd have to take their bodies off the line, would you?
We were considered, after we got those of us who recovered from cholera, we were considered, rightly or wrongly, temporarily immune from another attack, a form of vaccination or inoculation, I suppose. We were pressed into service by getting rid of some of these bodies, but it wasn't altogether successful. You could have to drag them to a central point and get some bamboo and try and burn them, but really it was a rotten job, because you might have to restack them the next day. They went out. It was a fearful job, really. But it just shows how, I suppose, when you get to those circumstances that how one becomes, what shall I say, brutalised.
So what, you've been a brake man and a footplate man and fish plate man.
I'd had a go at most of the things on the railway job, yeah.
When you came down with cholera, where were you taken?
Well, that was different. We were taken, the Japanese had a wholesale respect for anything like an epidemic. And certainly cholera, they wouldn't come near us. They sent those of us who were suffering from it, or diagnosed as suffering from it, to a small clearing about 2 miles out of the main camp, which was staffed with a wonderful character, a man named Parrish, Corporal Blondie Parrish of the Royal Army Medical Corps. And he had with him some equally staunch chaps from the Indian, other Indians from the Indian Medical Corps, four of them altogether, and they, not having had cholera themselves, of course, they were at great risk nursing these lot, but they did it. They were wonderful people. They worked, turned out enough, the tents were leaking and that sort of thing. They really were first-class people. Anything people says about the Army Medical Corps is nowadays to me, I'll defend them to the death. But the system was, they put you in the first tent when you arrived, and if you survived that, you were considered, it was considered you might survive, you might get over it, and you move to the next tent and so on up. Fortunately, I did. There was no treatment. I don't know much about cholera either, but I gather that the treatment for it at that time, and maybe still is, intravenous saline drops, because it tends to dehydrate the body. But I was given crystals of permanganate of potash every quarter of an hour. But my inside must have been black, I suppose. But I got the cramps, of course, which are quite painful with it. But I got over it, and I was, in that tent for about 5 days, shifted out to them.
What was the death rate from?
It was quite high. I think cholera carried off more than any other single illness, in my view. I never saw any statistics, but it's my impression that it was a much more fatal disease than the other things we suffered from. A man had a fair chance of getting over cholera, malaria, and dysentery, although a combination of the both, or quick, one following the other quicker, could kill him. But once a bad attack of cholera, with our state of health at that time, was more often than not fatal.
So you moved out of the first tent and into
the second. Mm-hmm. Then I thought I was going to survive, and I was sure I was going to survive. And I did.
How long did you spend in the second tent?
I think I was a week in there.
And then it was back to the...
And then it was back to... I got into the final, number four tent finally, where we were doing nothing. And then we moved on to another camp further up the line where some work was still proceeding. And just after that, I dropped out. I got ulcer scars on my legs, and I got malaria and dysentery. And then I was sent back down. By that time, the working party had got so far ahead, really, that I was sent back down to the base camp again at Nampla Duck, camp number 2, which is a very big camp.
What were the diseases that were most rife?
Well, the ones I've mentioned already, of course, but we had also scabies. You couldn't keep oneself clean. We had personal vermin. And we had, of course, most of the things brought on by lack of food, lack of nutrition. Beriberi, for example, that was a killer in its final state, dry or wet beriberi. And then with things like pellagra, which caused the... I think the pellagra caused the tongue to sort of peel and various other parts of the body to get very sore. It was, you couldn't do much about these things.
So you were a pretty disease-ridden lot, let's say.
Yeah.
And one of the main causes would have been the shortage of food.
Oh, yes, without doubt.
So you went back to
Nampla Duck camp number 2, where we were doing nothing really. Just occasional little jobs required to be done out on the railway, small bits of maintenance, small parties were taken, but we were doing nothing but hang about there.
What was the idea of that camp?
It was to get back people. I don't think the Japanese had any clear idea. At that time, I think they had ideas of a more permanent camp at a place called Nakhon Pattan, which was some miles away in the direction of Bangkok. They also had in mind, I'm pretty certain at that time, the certainty that a number of us would finish up in Japan working in their industries.
Had you been mixing freely with prisoners of war of other nationalities during the time?
Oh yes, the Dutch and Australians, of course, particularly. We didn't come into touch with the Americans until a good deal later. But we got on for the Australians, Dutch, and ourselves were the principal, well, the only ones, I suppose, in Thailand, certainly.
And how was discipline organised among yourselves?
Not too badly. I think it means good sense dictated this. My experience is you don't need, if men are at all intelligent, you don't need to impose discipline. If it comes a question of survival, they'll do it for themselves. They realise they've got to conform to certain standards if they're going to survive at all. And I think self-respect ensures that most of them do. Those that don't get short shrift normally from their fellows. I wouldn't say that the interracial relationships were quite as happy as they might have been. We got on very well with the Australians. Well, by the initial fight, I mean, the outlook's different from ours, but once you've met an Australian fought him, win or lose, you've met he respected you, we got on very well. But none was like the Dutch.
If anyone did commit a misdemeanour, what sort of punishments were there?
It depended what it was. If it was against the Japanese, of course, nothing, because he was expected to do that. But anything which militated against the interests of any of his own friends, certainly stealing, food particularly, was any stuff worth stealing, or clothes, food particularly, you should take the law in your own hands and give them a bit of a flogging. You couldn't report them to the Japanese. Well, you could have done, but it wouldn't... not the thing to do.
But as a whole, you all got on pretty well, really. There wasn't.
Oh, yes. Well, one had to. You couldn't remain at loggerheads with people. As I say, none of us like the Dutch. Make the mistake, I'm not talking about the European Dutch. They're a different race entirely, but the East Indies Dutch we found quite different.
What had sanitation been like in the camps up to...
All those same sort of borehole things, holes in the ground.
Was Nunkladuk number 2 any more luxurious?
It was a better camp in the sense that the huts were better found, they were a good deal more comfortable. And we did have a canteen, a proper canteen, which we'd organised when we were there initially, before we moved up the line. We'd got permission from the Japanese for local purchase and we started this canteen. But by the time we got back to it, the Dutch had taken it over. They'd come into the camp with so much money and all their personal possessions untouched, since they'd not put up a fight at all in the Dutch East Indies, that they priced us out of the canteen by that time. We couldn't get near it.
What was the currency that used it?
Little bits of cardboard with 5, 10, 15, 25, 50 cents printed on with a rubber stamp and signed by a Dutch officer.
And how did you get round your lack of currency?
Well, I told you earlier on I was determined to survive by whatever means, and I'd never been a forger in my life. But at that time I was chummed up with a big red-headed Australian of the name of Angus, of all the unlikely names. And we were both in our beam ends, really. We'd no money at all. And I got these ulcer scars over my feet, like sores over my feet, and he was no better. And he was sitting talking one day, and he said, you know, I reckon I could make a fair go. I'd rather stand out of a bit of a leather belt and I could fudge up some ink. So I'm like, you're only good at forging or signatures. I said, well, I don't know what you're doing. He said, well, I'll make some of these. I said, okay. So we made some, needless to say, 50 cents. We had no qualms about this. We'd started and established this canteen and we were priced out of it with the Dutch, whom at that time we despised, to be frank with you. And we passed these. They used to bring around Dutch orderlies, used to bring around all Dutch chaps who worked for this canteen, used to bring around what they called hot sweet coffee every night into various huts. It was really a sort of some sort of rough coffee flavour with a lot of sweet gula malacca in it. It was hot and it was sweet and it was quite pleasant to drink. And every hut we'd go in, they were working with a tiny little oil lamp, we'd change a 50 cent voucher and that sort of thing. But we got quite a lot of money. Then they notice went out that forgeries had been discovered in the... And they were changing the style of currency. But with that time, Angus and I were laughing, really. We'd made our killing.
How did you actually pass the tokens over?
Oh, in the dark at night, night of an oil lamp. They were quite convincing. I could sign that name now. His name was Hong Meiwen, and I could sign that now.
Had you got over your dysentery and your malaria?
Yes, substantially then, I had. It was what was besetting me then were these small ulcers around my feet, which I was getting a bit alarmed about, really. They couldn't do much about them. They really required sulphur drugs of some sort. I think it was sulfonamide, I'm not very sure. But they hadn't got it, and the Japs certainly wouldn't give you any. The Jats wouldn't give you even quinine, although they controlled the whole world supply at that time. They wouldn't give you any.
What was the treatment for the ulcers?
Well, it varied. Sometimes they would either dab raw lysol on them in the hope it would burn the infection out. It certainly certainly burned them out, if not the infection. Or they would scrape them with a spoon, sufficiently, cleaned first, and then bandage them in the hope that they wouldn't, go bad again. But the thing was, you needed sulfonamide. I'm very lucky indeed that the Dutch orderly here, who was coming around, he was cleaning these ulcers out, and he, not necessarily because he helped me on it, but he was a really good medical orderly. He saw these one morning, and he said, well, he took the view, I think, that they were small enough to be cured by some sort of sulfur drug, and he had two or three sulfur tablets. And he said, well, I'll get these clean and then sprinkle some of this in, which he did, and you could see the flesh granulate from day to day. But I still got the scars on my legs, but they could have been a lot worse. In fact, I could lay the ankle bare. They got the nasty things, trophic ulcers.
What were your sleeping conditions like then?
The same as they'd always been then. You see, these ATAP huts, as I say, were longish affairs. And in the central corridor down the middle of beaten earth, there was no floor in them, of course. And on each side, you had a little shelf, I suppose, raised off the floor, which of bamboos, which had been split and laid on a bamboo framework, which were about 6 feet long. And each man got a space, in other words, 6 feet by about 3 feet six or 4 feet, something like that, about 2 feet off the ground. That's where you lived and moved and had your being and kept such kit as you had.
Were flies a menace?
And indeed they were. You couldn't keep them down. It's one of my livelier memories, actually, trying to keep flies down. The Japanese realised the potential of these flies in terms of pestilence and so on. And orders went out, every man would kill, I think, starting off 20 flies a day, which everybody did, and they were counted. You had to form in little groups and had to count these dead bodies up and put in a little container hand into. And we made known, I mean, there must have been some 2,000 men in this camp. But it made no appreciable difference to these damn flies at all, these sort of great green and blue things. And then the numbers gradually went up, and it became difficult. Here I started to earn money again because I was getting a bit short. And I saw a chance because a lot of the chaps who were actually going out working on the railway were being paid 10 cents a day. And if they worked for 10 days, they got a dollar. But it didn't leave them very much time to catch their flies. Yep, before light and back after very often. And I would offer to catch their flies for them for just 10 cents, which was one day's pay for the whole period, which I did. And I found it very easily because nothing else to do. You could buy a mango, you see, from the from the canteen, or anything sweet really, and make a big fly swat of a piece of ATAP and choose a flat space, preferably a flat stone if you could find one. You could eat the mango and smear the mango stone over it, and the place would be black with flies the next night. I mean, with one swipe you'd kill quite a lot of them. Then you'd put them into separate bottles for your customers and so on.